Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. By the year 2050, the world's population is expected to surpass 9 billion people, and the planet's temperature is expected to rise by more than 4 degrees. So with climate change and water shortages, is it possible to feed another 3 billion people without further wrecking the planet? How will we feed ourselves in 2050? These are the questions Sarah Elton explores in her new book, Consumed, Food for a Finite Planet. Climate change is interfering with the way we produce our food, and at the same time, she points out that few of us know where that food even comes from, let alone how to grow it. And we're at the mercy of multinationals that control the food chain with little insight into the damage their methods are inflicting on the planet. And this puts our future at risk. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on the true cost of our current food system. Sarah traveled to three continents to research her book, and she reports on the efforts of people who are creating alternatives to the industrial food system. What can we learn from local agricultural models around the world? What's really working? And are these alternative models enough to feed billions of people? Sarah Elton is a journalist and best-selling author. Her new book is called Consumed, Food for a Finite Planet. Sarah is also food columnist for CBC Radio 1's Here and Now, and she'll be giving a talk about how to feed the world without destroying the planet at UC Berkeley today at 1 o'clock. And on Thursday at 8 o'clock p.m., she'll be at the Port Commission Hearing Room, which is on the second floor of the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And Sarah Elton joins me in studio. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So you're taking on a massive topic. We were just talking about just how big this is. If you're talking about feeding 9 billion people, you're dealing with climate change, multinationals. But I wanted to start off on a more positive note, because you traveled to three continents and you interviewed people who are doing really great things. What, when you, now that you're sitting here doing interviews, what really stands out for you about what you learned?
I think it was the global nature of this social movement that is responding to these big and paralyzing issues. Before going out and doing my research and traveling, I could fall for the same trap, when we think of sustainable agriculture in North America, we think of green roofs, we think of urban agriculture, we think of farmers markets and CSAs. But then I traveled to rural China and, met peasant farmers who are working in the rice paddies who care about reducing their pesticide use in their rice paddies, and then meet women in rural India who share the same values of wanting to build a sustainable food system that is, financially just for them and works for them, environmentally speaking, too, like to nurture their ecology. Everybody, all these little people around the world, in my city, all across North America, in every country I visited, all these individuals thinking the same thing. And, you take a step back and you think, wow, that's a lot of people. This is a big social movement. And we don't really know how big it is because there are all these tiny little projects all over the world. But together, it's a lot of social might.
Well, and the thing is, when you look at media coverage, Monsanto and DuPont and Dow are the ones that get a lot of the attention. And then the fight against GMOs get a lot of attention. But these efforts really don't. When you talk to local people about the big multinationals and what we're currently facing, what did that conversation sound like?
Well, the conversations in other countries really mirrored what the kind of conversations I hear too, because people just are generally unaware of how many colleagues they have, how many allies they have at the grassroots. Understandably, we focus on the big issues and the big corporations and the big problems, but we don't make those connections. And I was in a taxi in Beijing one night with a professor who had she'd worked to help a rice growing village that was having a lot of problems, and their family members were going to work in the factories because they couldn't make money growing rice. And so what she did was she helped them connect with people, get off chemicals, connect with people in the city who were willing to pay more for that organic rice. And she freed them from having to send their family members away to work in the factory. And then she said to me, but what have I done? This is just one village and there's thousands of villages more where people have to go away. But yes, it's just one village, but if we connect all these dots, it's actually a huge social movement, and that's what I wanted to report on and tell the world.
Tell another story, because the journey begins in Bidkin, a village in the western Indian state of Maharashtra, and where we meet Chandrakala?
Yeah, Chandrakala Bobain. Yes, she's an organic farmer now, and a, you know, what people might call in the sustainable food movement here, I've heard the word starmer. You know, she's really had incredible success. But not that long ago, Chandrakala was an impoverished farmer trying to grow using all the tools of the Green Revolution, like chemical fertilizer and pesticides, and buying her seeds. But she couldn't make enough money growing food to pay for her to pay her costs and her costs of living in her family. So she was taught by an NGO how to grow organically, which meant her costs went down. She didn't have to pay for all those inputs anymore. And in her area, it's a very arid area. In fact, organic agriculture yields more food, 30% more to be exact. And so her yields went up. And then this organization created a new local food chain. They called it the Organic Bazaar, same as our farmer's market, where people can come and buy straight from the farmer or food that is organic, certified in their community. And so she makes more money. She calls this her sunrise, because her life transformed so dramatically from being a struggling farmer who often had to work as a day laborer picking cotton to now being a thriving organic farmer. And she's the president of a cooperative of more than 1,000 women farmers who are working together, and they've changed their reality, not just ecologically speaking, because now they're farming in a different way, in a organic way, but also their financial situation. They've built this new economy that's more fair for them.
Well, and this is a rare good news story in a country in which a farmer commits suicide every 30 seconds.
Is it staggering? 30 seconds? Staggering statistics. When I was there, the equivalent of the big news magazine was doing a big report on just how bad the farming situation was and the farmer suicides in India. Staggering, because people cannot pay for the inputs. Just going organic is financially the better thing to do. And I've seen the other farmers make that decision as well, not necessarily motivated by ecological mindset, but just financially deciding, geez, it makes more sense if I can grow things without having to buy all this extra stuff.
I mean, this has been going on for a few years.
A long time, yes.
And it continues to this day?
It continues to this day.
When you look at what we're facing with 9 billion people expected in 2050, and, you know, we talked a little bit about the Farm Bill, food policy in the United States, food policy where you're from in Canada, what do you think are the biggest problems we face right now?
You know, the biggest problems, I think, are not necessarily the ones that are right in our face. They're the problems that we live with and we see as normal. And one thing I think is the disappearance of agricultural land. That really struck me wherever I went. I saw the same thing. Houses being built on what was farmland, you know, moments ago. Mm. Industry expanding on farmland. Wherever I've traveled in rural areas where people aren't so concerned if there's a new big box store building in a field nearby, or a new subdivision, because, hey, there's farmland everywhere. Or around a city, you know, the city grows and it eats up more land. I think we're not really paying that close attention to what's going on, but that is a crisis. Also, in areas where we're seeing land grabs, and where farmers in countries such as Ethiopia or indigenous people are finding big agribusiness taking over their land and starting plantations. And this is a we have to pay attention to who owns the land and what it's being used for. Is it being used to feed us? Is it being how is it being farmed sustainably? Is it a big monocrop plantation that's growing a biofuel? These are key questions in figuring out how to feed the people in the future.
And this is because we're seeing so much development, especially in these countries.
And land is such a financial, it's an investment. It's seen as an investment opportunity for people. Land is worth so much money everywhere that people are motivated for financial reasons to invest in land, or to build a subdivision, or to, you know, start a biofuel oil palm plantation.
How are local farmers responding to that?
I think people are aware that this is a serious problem, but it's mixed too, because farmers who struggle, this is very common where I'm from in Ontario, farmers struggle to make a living, and so if they want to retire, they would like to sell their land to a developer, because then they make their pension, because they haven't been paid properly for their what the service they provided society for their whole career, and so they want to cash out and understandably live a comfortable retirement. It's complex. It's not straightforward.
Yeah, the New York Times had a piece recently about older organic farmers getting together and talking about how their children are not taking on their farms. It's very rare because it's so much work and it's just not financially lucrative.
There is an amazing story in Quebec and in Canada of people in exactly that situation. They're an organic farmer outside of the city of Montreal. He was at a retirement and he didn't know what to do. And so the community got together and they bought the land, and it's now an in trust. And his daughter, who would never have been able to buy the land because she was young and didn't have the money to pay for this valuable real estate, she's now farming the land organically. But it's the community that owns the land. They preserved their organic farm in their community. And the people who own the land now are allowed to, they get first dibs on the food, you know, in perpetuity, and they can even will it to their kids.
Now, when you write about these alternative systems, whether it's in India or China or the United States and Canada, let's say these did morph and a lot of people embrace these alternatives, would that be enough to feed 9 billion people by 2050?
Good question. I think there are many other issues that we have to consider as well, like meat. And how we use our land to grow feed for massive livestock production, waste along the food chain. You know, around in North America, it's about 30% of what is grown is wasted. So there are many efficiencies or improvements that we could make along the food chain. It's not just about, oh, here we have to switch and move to a different paradigm entirely. There's a lot of different things that have to happen, and the policy, the government policy to support all these things as well.
Right, and the Farm Bill is expected to be signed any day now here in the United States. When you look at changes you'd like to see, what's at the top of your list?
The protection of agricultural land, and also ways to help new farmers get on the land to farm, ways to finance new farmers to work, and more. You know, there's a lot of people in not just North America, but in other countries. Food safety rules it's complex. Everybody would like food when they buy it, but sometimes the rules are made for large farms, and it makes it very hard for small farmers to be able to abide by the legislation and the rules, follow the rules, and sell their food without investing in a man's washroom and a woman's washroom at their abattoir that has one employee, for example, rules like that just don't fit small food chains. So I think that's a big would be a big step forward, is figuring out how to do that. And then research in the public domain into organic agriculture. Organic agriculture fares pretty well when you look at the yield results, when you look at the yields compared to conventional. But often they're not quite as high as conventional. Well, all our research dollars have gone into creating and building this conventional food system, this industrial food system. All the corporate investment, everything is all focused on that. Well, what if we invested our brains and our innovation and our money into building something that is truly sustainable? Imagine what we could have.
Talk a little bit about how the multinational landscape has changed over the years, just in terms of major mergers that we're seeing, and how much of our food comes, it's a huge amount, but how much of our food comes from multinationals as opposed to small farmers?
Well, I think most people would be eating food, unless you make an effort not to, and a valiant effort, you're going to be buying from the mainstream food chain. It's hard to disengage. I have managed to do that, and depending where you live, it's easier to do.
Right.
In this area, from what I can tell, just from being around it and looking in the shops, because I love to be a tourist in grocery stores and farmers markets, but it seems easier here, but in most places in the United States and Canada and even Europe, we have an idealized version of what happens in Europe. But no, you talk to people there, and they say it's the same thing. Most things are from the corporate food chain, and it's hard to escape that.
What role do you see the multinationals playing by 2050?
That's a very good question. And that's a question, as a journalist, that I asked people wherever I went, because I didn't know the answer. And It turns out nobody knows the answer. You know, some people would say, people would ask me the question back as I'm asking you the question back, but they'd say, you know, is the supermarket a dinosaur of our time, or can the supermarket adapt to the food chain of the future? I think we're seeing supermarkets playing a role right now, because how can you feed so many people in the city? Not everybody can go to a farmer's market. Not everybody. It's just not, it would logistically would be impossible. Not all farmers want to go to the farmer's market. Many farmers just want to sell. It's, you know, work on their fields. Understandably, they don't want to do that marketing as well. So we've seen supermarkets, you know, source their food differently. We're seeing some supermarkets growing food to sell on the roof of the actual supermarket. So supermarkets are turning out to be a little bit nimble right now. We're seeing changes. Like, where today versus just a few years ago, it's amazing how much change there's been.
Like, for example, Monsanto, I just had this up on my computer and it just went down, but they just bought this massive, oh, here it comes back good. Monsanto just spent $930 million to buy a San Francisco startup called the Climate Corporation. And it allows, it gives farmers a lot of information about the land. It can provide insurance and recommend when it's best for farmers to irrigate, apply chemicals, harvest, or plant. And then farmers can also use a web-based dashboard to track current weather and soil conditions and forecasts. I mean, this is almost $1 billion Monsanto spent on this. And now they have access to really important data about soil and about land. What are your thoughts on this?
That's a good question. You know, often people, when we think of sustainable food systems, they think it's about going back in history and mirroring what happened in the past. But we have so many tools and so much innovation at our disposal today that a sustainable food system that can be resilient and respond to our changing climate, we will need to draw on our innovation and our resources and all these brains, this human brain work that has created ways of figuring out, you know, what is the fertility of the soil? What does this particular field need versus that particular field? And how can we best use the water? So we don't waste our irrigation water. How do we best use it? How can we focus? And I think that is the key, is to blend what's called traditional knowledge, which would be the knowledge of farmers growing over millennia, combine this traditional knowledge, but also, don't, we can't turn our back on science, and we need to embrace both mindsets and move into the future and combine them together. And some people say, and I love this expression, that the farmer in some ways is a scientist. It's the farm. We need farmer scientists in the future. The farmer who understands the ecology and who understands the tools at hand and who can grow food in the best way, this most sustainable way.
We're speaking with Sarah Elton. She's a journalist and best-selling author. Her latest book is Consumed: Food for a Finite Planet. And she will be speaking today at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism from 1 to 2 p.m. And then tomorrow she'll be speaking at 6 o'clock at the San Francisco Ferry Building Port Commission Herring Room, second floor at the Ferry Building at the Embarcadero at Market Street. And today we are talking about, how will we feed another 3 billion people by 2050? The population is expected to surpass 9 billion people, and then the temperature is expected to rise by more than about 4 degrees. So with climate change and water shortages, we're actually going to do a show tomorrow about California agriculture and water. Is it possible to feed another 3 billion people without wrecking the planet with so many pesticides and chemicals? What are your thoughts on this issue? What would you like to see changed in the food supply? And when you think about 9 billion people in 2050 and feeding them all, what comes to mind? I mean, a lot of people out there say that we actually have enough food for 9 billion people. The problem is the policies that we have just don't make sense. And then Sarah also talked about waste and things. So what would you like to see change in the food system, and what concerns you most about our food system? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Sarah talks about some alternatives to this food industrial system around the world, and if you have any you'd like to share, you can give us a call or email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So what are your thoughts on these different studies? One just came out of McGill University, University of Minnesota, looking at organic and conventional yields. And they found that we already grow enough food for 10 billion people, actually. And we can't end hunger because our policies are backwards.
Yes. There are so many complex intertwining issues. And we have ample food in this world, and it's about distribution. And also, we have to look at what we're growing in our fields as well. We grow a lot of biofuels on farmland, and we grow a lot of feed for livestock that we probably don't need to. Well, we don't need to be growing, and we especially shouldn't be growing if we're thinking about the climate for the future.
And that uses a lot of water.
A huge amount of water. In fact, all agriculture. I mean, whether or not it's organic or agriculture or not, agriculture is the number one source of water use. We use water to cook our food or to wash or whatever, but no, it's number one source is agriculture. And everybody, whether or not you're a sustainable farm or not, you need water and you use a lot of it.
Right. We're talking about that on Thursday. I just read that a half a year's worth of showering equals a pound of beef.
Wow. Yeah, that's
and,
a lot of water.
You know, we're really paying attention to this in California right now. The other problem is poverty, right? Because people who make less than $2 a day have a really hard time buying this food.
And that's a key issue that is connected to food. You can't talk about food and sustainability without talking about the economic sustainability of the food system. So what I write about in the book also is about how do we buy and sell our food in a way that works for the farmers, so farmers aren't impoverished when they're growing with the food that we need to eat, and so that people can afford to buy food and have access to food. You know, in large swaths of big cities in North America, people don't have access to healthy food. So what new models can we build that address these issues? And those are the models that I highlight and write about in the book.
What about pricing? Because we've seen food riots around the world. 15 years ago, the cost of a bushel of wheat was $3. In 2008, it rose to $10. I mean, that's a massive increase, especially if you're making $2 a day. When you look at the high rise in food, why is this happening? Are you looking at Wall Street basically is also involved in this around the world.
Yeah, I mean that's the crux of the issue, is that food and land are now things that we invest in.
And on the speculation market. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, yeah, it's an investment. We have to think about how we treat food and we see food. So is food going to be a commodity? Is food going to be an investment? Is land, agricultural land, going to be an investment opportunity? Or is food a human right? Is land part of our common heritage as human beings on this planet? And this really is a cultural shift. And the third part of my book is about here we have all these changes that need to take place by 2050 if we want to feed ourselves sustainably. But how do we support these as consumers? Well, that is about changing our culture. So what can we do to have a new culture that supports that? So when I go to the store, I want to buy the food that supports the kind of system that can feed us into the future. It would be my values. How do I show my values when I shop? Well, I need a new culture. I need a new food culture. So that's what I write about in the third part of the book.
Sarah Elton is a journalist and best-selling author. Her new book is called Consumed, Food for a Finite Planet. By 2050, the population is expected to surpass 9 billion people, and the temperature is expected to rise by more than 4 degrees. So given these realities, is it possible to feed another 3 billion people without further wrecking the planet? How will we feed ourselves in 2050? These are the questions Sarah explores in her new book, Consumed. And if you'd like to join us, what changes would you like to see to the food system? What concerns you the most, and what questions do you have about how this all works? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you think hasn't been heard yet in today's discussion, or a question you'd like to hear answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say, here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will take a look at Covered California. She'll talk about the failures and successes of California's new healthcare exchange. We've had a lot more success than many other states, but Covered California still suffers from low enrollment, and many clients say they're having a hard time finding a doctor or hospital that will take a plan purchase through the exchange. So what has your experience been like? We'd love to hear from you on tomorrow's show. And then on Thursday, we will talk about agriculture and water use. Who is using the most water? What are they using it for? What crops are most water intensive? And are these farmers flexible in terms of crop change? In many cases, they really have no choice but to be flexible because of the drought that we're currently facing. That's on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about food and our food system. Is it possible to feed another 3 billion people by 2050 without further wrecking the planet? How will we do it? Sarah Elton traveled to three continents to interview people who are creating alternatives to the industrial food system, and she writes about that and so many other issues in her new book called Consumed, Food for a Finite Planet. She'll be speaking today at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism at 1 o'clock, and then tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the Port Commission Hearing Room, second floor of the Ferry Building, Embarcadero at Market in San Francisco. And if you'd like to join us, we've got one line open at 866-798-8255. This issue gets a lot of attention. We do many, many food shows on Your Call. So what changes would you like to see, and what changes have you seen over the years when it comes to creating a sustainable food supply? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Janine in Sausalito. Hi, Janine. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you so much. Just another reason why I feel so blessed to have KALW in our midst. I'm so grateful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. What a wonderful program. I look forward to reading this book. It's critical to us. And I'm hoping that within it the author will address the what's happening with our exporting of the American diet and our beef-centered diet and what it's doing globally by our exporting that, as far as, I mean, just basically even addressing just the water consumption. And again, this morning, thank you for sharing that fact that one-half use, you can take showers for one-half of a year, that water consumption equates to 1 pound of beef production. I mean, it's astonishing. And we know that that is not the case to produce 1 pound of green vegetables or 1 pound of rice or potatoes. So that model alone just shifts everything and is a far more responsible approach to sustaining all life forms going forward. And the American model is not sustainable. We do know this. I mean, the clear-cutting of the Amazon, I mean, there are so many reasons why this is not a sustainable model. And that we're exporting it at such a rapid pace is shocking and adding to the further depletion of our resources. So I'm hoping you address that in the book, and thank you so much for the program.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually looking for some numbers because I was sharing this data with some friends yesterday because people are concerned about showers and washing and things like that. But Sarah, what are your thoughts on this? Because you've got the UN coming out saying, you know, if you want to save the planet, eat less meat. But Janine makes a great point. I mean, when you look at India and China and places in South America, meat consumption is really on the rise.
Yeah, I'm so glad Janine called. Thanks, because, and made this point, because meat, not only is meat consumption up, but industrial meat production is just staggering and expanding rapidly. Janine, you're right. We need this new culture of sustainability, a new culture of food. But unfortunately, it's the North American diet that's quickly expanding, you know, across Asia and the subcontinent. And I watched this in real time when I was in India. It was baffling to me. There was a new mall. I was in the city of Aurangabad, just near Chandrakala's farm, and I went there. Check it out. Got to see social change in action. And there was a submarine sandwich shop. And I went back and I told the people, yeah, they sell submarines with a ham and cheese sandwich. And they went white and their mouths dropped open. They said, this is mostly a Hindu town and a Muslim town. No one eats pork here. Like, the fact that you can go to a mall, I was telling them how their city had changed. And they said, yeah, the supermarket just opened and now we can go buy prepared foods. We can buy all these prepared curries.
Wow.
That we couldn't have done
prepared
that.
Prepared curry?
Yeah, no one had done this before. But now you could go get your meat curry or your egg curry or what at the supermarket, just like we do here in North America. So I was they said, yes, yes. And then, look, if you look around the lunchroom, people used to eat rotis made from... and now I'm thinking, I can only think of the word in Marathi, but anyway, a local grain, but now people are starting to eat, to eat wheat rotis. So things are the flatbread that you eat with your curries with this flatbread, instead of this gluten-free grain.
Wow. What else did you see around on the three continents that surprised you about sort of how the West is exporting our way of life when it comes to eating to other countries?
Well, in China, I was surprised by just the pervasiveness in Beijing and the subway system of the fast food advertising and how it was it's seen as a status to go out to a fast food joint here, somewhere where you might go for a quick dinner, a quick lunch here. It's special to go out for fried chicken or a pizza at a North American brand fast food chain.
And are these places fairly packed?
They're opening. Like the statistic was when I wrote the book and when I fact checked that, it was like a chain a day is opening.
Wow.
So this is huge.
Wow. Well, thank you again for calling in. Do you see that this trend just continuing? And I mean, when you're writing about feeding the 9 billion people by 2050, if this is the trend we're on, what does this mean?
I mean, that's what I struggled with the whole time. I mean, yes, this is the mainstream. So how do we find hope for a more sustainable future if that's what everybody wants? But it's when that's the mainstream and there's all the advertising dollars and all the focus on the mainstream, we forget these little undercurrents. And I think that people, what they really actually want when you talk to people is that they want, just like we do, you know, good food. People, wherever I went, they said, you know what, I'd actually really prefer to buy food from a farmer. I like that better, but I don't have those options available to me. And so people don't really often have the real choice. In India, in the same town, I took a day off from my research to go to a tourist site, the caves of Ajanta and Ellora. And my guide, no idea that I was a journalist researching food, just out of the blue starts talking. He's like, you know, I can't believe it. I want to buy what he called desi eggs. He said, you know, the chickens that run around and they peck the dirt, those are the eggs I want to buy. But now all I'm getting are English eggs, i.e. industrial food system eggs. And what's happening? I don't have this choice anymore. I want to go to the little Kirana store in my neighborhood and buy these eggs, but I can't. So I think in their hearts, I mean, maybe I'm being very optimistic, but I do believe that many, many of us really just would like, you know, good, clean, fair food, in the words of the slow food movement.
Well, thanks again for calling, Janine. Be sure to tune in on Thursday and we'll talk more about how much water is used for fruits and vegetables and then how much water is used for agriculture and meat and the dairy industry. So thanks for calling in. Let's go next to Scott in Oakland. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask a question and make a comment about the relative weight of the issue of overpopulation versus farm policies. I heard long ago, and it may no longer be current information, but I heard long ago that population rates, even in the most advanced industrial countries, are declining, and the focus of the story that I read was on Catholic countries, which prior to that had very high birth rates. But as each of these countries that traditionally had high birth rates continued to industrialize and become more urban, the birth rates naturally declined. So my first question is, what is the database for the projection that we'll have 9 billion people by the year 2050 or whatever it is? How reliable is that? And then secondly, I wanted to comment on farm policies, because I'd also read long ago, and perhaps your guest can bring us current on this, is that there's enough food right now available, at least a productive capacity, albeit through factory farm systems that we think need a lot of improvement. There's enough food available to feed everybody that walks on the planet and everyone that lives on the planet. And the one example that stuck in my mind was... it was claimed that Brazil has the most arable farmland in the entire Western Hemisphere and also, ironically, the most undernourished population, the largest number of undernourished people, because the landowning system is built for making money, and they produce coffee for export rather than food in many cases. And so a lot of people go hungry when there's plenty of capacity to feed them. They don't go hungry for lack of food. Mm. They go hungry because they lack the money to buy food.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, we addressed that a bit earlier, but we can elaborate on it. And it's important to note, and you point this out, that farmers produce 145% more food today than they did just a couple of decades ago. And agriculture is responsible for more than a third of greenhouse gases worldwide.
So, yes.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, to his point,
yes.
We talked about this earlier, that there's enough food out there, but a lot of people can't afford it.
Yes. And we produce so much food. Thank you to the Green Revolution and all these advances. But I think we have to also take a step back and say, how do we measure the success of our food system, which is what I think Scott was pointing out. Is our food system successful just by producing a lot of food, or is a successful food system one where everybody can eat and everyone can afford to eat? And in Brazil, in fact, there are interesting projects by the government to make healthy fruits and vegetables affordable to everybody. So they have these fruit and vegetable markets where regular people can go and they can afford to buy fruits and vegetables. It's the policy. Mm. Also around the world, there are many lunch programs in schools where kids, and I know in the United States, across the country, you have food at lunches. Lots of issues involved there. I know, not always good. I know some schools and school districts have made an effort to turn this into healthy food and food rather than, you know, foods that are industrial. But around the world, there are countries like France, like Italy, where in Italy they source the school lunches from organic farms, small local organic farms, and then they serve these lunches to kids, and in a way that they believe it's part of the cultural education. So a child should come to school and eat a healthy organic lunch, get the nutrition, and also learn that this is an important part of being Italian is eating healthy, nutritious foods. You know, when I read the menu of one of these school lunches, it read like a restaurant menu, like primi, secondi, and thought, wow, in Canada, we don't have a lunch program for our kids. I was very jealous. But it's all about what the state decides to provide its people.
Well, and he also brought up policies. And again, the farm bill in the U.S. is about to be signed. And 75% of farm subsidies are handed to 10% of farmers. These are the wealthiest farmers. And it's a similar story in Canada, right? In 2010, only 3% of Canadian farms had sales of a million or more. But it was these farmers who received about 20% of government subsidies.
Yeah.
And there's always that question, why is the salad more expensive than the hamburger?
Yeah. And subsidies are a massive issue, and I think people on all sides of the political spectrum will say that the subsidy systems need to be reformed. People who believe in open markets and who believe in the industrial food system and the free flow of goods are against subsidies, and people who care about healthy foods being affordable and lettuce being, you know, fairly priced versus a hamburger, they care about subsidies too. So that is a critical issue. How are our tax dollars spent in a way that creates that supports the kind of food system that can feed us and that creates this fair and just and clean food system that we want?
Sarah Elton is a journalist and best-selling author. Her latest book is Consumed: Food for a Finite Planet. She'll be speaking today at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism at 1 o'clock. The talk will be hosted by Michael Pollan, and then tomorrow at 6 o'clock, she'll be at the Port Commission Hearing Room, second floor of the Ferry Building Embarcadero at Market. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. When you think about the food system and the prospect of feeding 9 billion people by 2050, how do you think we should go about this? What changes would you like to see? And if you are familiar or involved with any alternatives to this industrial system, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You brought up the Green Revolution and technology earlier, and we've got a caller on that. So let's hear from Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew.
Hi. My heart really wants to be with you and Miss Elton on this issue. Somehow or another, farming in a more sustainable way, it kind of emotes a nostalgia for the past, and Miss Elton brought that up. But the one thing that, you know, I keep on coming back to is that Malthusian predictions of, you know, the population outstripping food supply and, you know, the earth becoming unsustainable have been around for ages. And yet, we're in a time when more people eat more food, more cheaply, more healthily than they ever have in the history of the planet. And so it's hard to look back at technology that has brought us to this point and say, oh, wow, now from this point onward, Malthus's predictions are going to be realized. And I just wonder what Miss Elton, how she, you know, squares that circle in her own head.
Drew, I wrote this book for you. I'm not kidding. When so many people have come up to me and made that confession, when I talk about, I'm an environmental journalist, I write about these things, and they come up to me and they say, in my heart, I want to believe in sustainable food, but, and then they say exactly what you just said, and that was a question I wanted to understand, and when I embarked on this journey. And I think the big issue that's different today that just throws a spanner in the whole works of everything is climate change. We've never had to deal with climate change before, so it changes everything, and it makes a status quo just, well, unsustainable. Going forward, we have no choice but to make sure that our food system does not contribute to greenhouse gas emissions as it does today. If the food system is responsible for a huge proportion of our greenhouse gas emissions, livestock alone is somewhere, depending on which estimate you take, and there's lots of discussion, but 15 to 18% in that realm, livestock production alone of our greenhouse gas emissions. So we have to fix this problem. Also, the food system of the industrial food system is not resilient to these changing climates, and it's not resilient to the extreme weather conditions that we are already experiencing right now. And so we have to figure out what is a better way that can deal with climate change. So how do we plant our crops in a way that if there is a massive drought, we have the biodiversity in our seed stock that can respond? How do we take care of our animals and our cows if in a drought? Milk production in India is predicted to drop dramatically in the next decade because of the warming weather and climate in India. These are huge issues, and it's all laid at the feet of climate change.
And we're dealing with that in California because we're the breadbasket in the country, and we've got a drought right now. Are you still with us?
Drew.
Drew.
Yeah, that's all right. Let me put you back on so we get better voice quality. The thing that, you know, you talk about climate change and that the current system doesn't have the flexibility to accommodate, you know, the changes that are coming or even the current changes. And yet, if you look at commodity prices, I mean, prices have gone up, but, you know, again, depending on where you are in the world and how you look at it, they're still within affordability ranges for many, many more people than they ever have been in the history of the world. And, you know, even in California, they're making adjustments to deal with the drought conditions. You know, almond farmers are trying to find, you know, new almond trees that are resistant to salt so that, you know, they can use more groundwater to water. And, you know, I can see, again, in my heart, I see that this is something that is a great danger. But yet, people like us have, throughout history, made these predictions. And in every instance, we've been wrong. And so it's really hard to be confident with this argument, given, you know, and again, it's an inductive argument. You know, the sun rose yesterday, so it'll run right today, you know. Who knows, maybe it won't tomorrow. That, you know, it's not a deduction, but at the same time, it's you know, the past, people have made this prediction so many times, it's really difficult, you know, to accept.
All right, thank you, Drew, for calling in. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I can go to my supermarket now when you have this big drought in California and buy a lettuce for $1.99. And I live on the other side of the continent in the north where it's negative 30 Celsius right now. That's very cold. And when there's a drought in Texas a few years ago, I could go to the supermarket and buy a watermelon for $2.99, $3.99. Like, cheap. Why? And the answer to what Drew just said, I would say, is there's a massive market failure. The reason all this food is so cheap is because, well, the the market has failed to price things at their true cost. So that watermelon, that lettuce, it has a much higher cost in a drought to these water heavy crops. I'm not paying the true cost of those foods when I buy that in my supermarket. And so if we were to price food in a way that represented the true environmental cost, well, food that was grown in a way that takes care of the water and minimizes irrigation and nurtures the soil and nurtures biodiversity, this food would in fact be more affordable than in food that has this huge environmental cost if we paid for the true cost at the cash register.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Drew. And we've got full lines. Let's try to go through as many as we can. Let's hear from David in Santa Cruz. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi, Rose. Really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, you know, tell a little anecdotal story. I've worked, my grandparents had farms in the Dakotas, and I used to go out there as a, you know, farmhand in the summer. My first summer, you know, we planted a beautiful crop of wheat. It's the pasta triangle of the world up there. First truckload in, the farmer that I was working for told me to take it back to the farm and dump it because the U.S. government was going to pay all the farmers more that year to let it rot. So, you know, at 15, I'm obviously, I saw what the true farm policy was. I mean, we can feed the world, and to pay American farmers across the fruited plains to actually let their food rot was astounding. It's just a matter of distribution and, you know, basically greed and farm policies. And we should try to get our farm policies, the monies directed towards converting conventional farming into organic and sustainable. I know it's a really hard political slog, but it's got to happen. And I'm working with some farmers out in the Dakota on that. I've been into organic farming for 30 years. So I just wanted to give that little story that, you know, I'm dating myself, but it's been going on for years. You know, depending on the commodity prices, American farmers are paid to throw it away.
Hmm. Wow. Really. Thank you for that story. Is that still going on? Do you know, Sarah?
I've heard many people tell me similar stories. Mm-hmm. I worked on this farm and I watched, you know, the carrots get dumped in the field and plowed under or whatever. It's all about price and how we value what we value.
Well, and then we didn't even talk about trade policy and how that affects food. But there have been documentaries that show, for example, in Jamaica, a lot of people didn't sell their own milk and their milk powder, really, and their own bananas because it was cheaper to import them.
Yes. And I do dive into that in the book. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got time for a few more calls. Let's hear from Deborah in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah.
Good morning. I'd like to comment and hear a little bit more from our author about, and she touched upon this earlier, about an awareness of where our food comes from. And I believe that those of us in the city have lost touch of where our foods are originating from. And I think that our specialty markets, such as Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, and I'm not singling them out, they're the ones that come to mind, they've done a great job highlighting organic and sustainable foods and processes. But I think, on the other hand as well, you know, we see in those same supermarkets food that's coming from other countries, and I'd like to see more support for our local farmers, and hopefully that will make an impact on how we here view land and rather than as a commodity but as a necessity here in the States. And I'm wondering if you can comment a little more on that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're right, Deborah. I agree. We lack this awareness of where our food comes from. We don't understand that when we eat, we are actually taking the biosphere into our bodies. We are part of the biosphere. So when we think of what culture do we need to support these sustainable food systems, I think that's the heart of the matter. How do we reawaken this knowledge that we are part of the cycles of life? That when we eat, we are eating the sun, you know, it's just coming to us via animals and plants, and that's a challenge for all of, you know, we're increasingly an urban population, an urban species around the world. More and more of us are living in cities, so that is at the heart of the issue. How can we awaken this realization, this profound realization that we are part of nature, just like an asparagus?
what would you say are the main things that we can do? What actions can we take? I mean, of course, buy organic, buy local. I mean, but if you have the means to do that, that's great. But what else?
Well, I think what's available to everybody is to try to get involved in planting planting in a garden. There are lots of community gardens open, available for everybody. In my city, it's hard to get a plot of land, but you can join a community garden where you farm a piece of land as a group, and start a project. I mean, you have to have passion, but at schools all around San Francisco, wherever I've been going in the last few days, I see all these amazing school gardens. Get kids involved, volunteer, you know, try to get that connection yourself and in your own families, even planting a small plant on a windowsill if you can.
Well, Alex, we couldn't take Alex, but he wanted to talk about gardening in his backyard. And then also for the bigger picture, and hopefully we're going to talk about media coverage of the Farm Bill on Friday, but how do you see that playing out in terms of these big, like a $1 trillion farm bill and these big policy changes? What will it take to see major change there?
Well, I think the power is with the voter, and who do we choose, who do we vote for wherever we live in whatever country? Who do we vote for when we go to the ballot box? That's where we do in a democracy. We should be able to vote for policies that we believe in. In the sustainable food movement, people say, you know, you vote with your fork. Yes, that's true. But these big changes, they also require the right policy. And so when we vote and speak up, you know, speak your mind. I know since writing this book, I used to bite my tongue a lot in social circles and just let things go. But no, now I'm going to be that person at the dinner table who says, actually.
You'll be the Debbie the Downer,
yeah.
Right?
No, I try not to be the Downer. Sarah the Upper.
That's like. But that's good. Keep that up. Sarah Elton is author of Consumed, Food for a Finite Planet. She'll be speaking today at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism at 1 o'clock and tomorrow at 6 o'clock, Port Commission Hearing Room, second floor of the Ferry Building. Thanks so much for coming in, Sarah.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Is Covered California working for you? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the failures and successes of California's new healthcare exchange. Covered California has had better success than other states, but it still suffers from low enrollment, especially among Latinos and youth. And many clients are having a hard time finding a doctor or a hospital that will take a plan purchased through the exchange. So what has your experience been like? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.